You're listening to a 4x4 Radio Network podcast.
The Center Steer Podcast, a Land Rover podcast by Land Rover owners.
Welcome to the Center Steer Podcast, the only Land Rover podcast on the planet. This is show number 46 for January 2017. Happy New Year to everybody around the world. This is a podcast by, for, and about Land Rover owners. Visit our website, centersteer.com, that's in the British spelling, C-E-N-T-R-E, to listen to previous shows and for show notes, which have links to stories discussed in today's show. We are also part of the 4x4 Radio Network, and I invite you to check out the other shows on the network at 4x4radionetwork.com. Thanks for your comments, follows, and likes on Facebook, Twitter, and in emails. And a special thanks to our Patreon subscribers. If you wish to help support the show on a monthly basis, go ahead out to patreon.com/centersteer, again, in the British spelling, for all the details and to make your contribution. I am your host, John Costage, here in wonderful southwestern Pennsylvania, where it snowed a little bit, but there's hardly any snow on the ground, and it's finally gotten cold here for the wintertime. I always like to talk about the weather. Not sure why. It's a thing. Also joining me this time via Skype is from the wonderful Latrobe, Pennsylvania.
Bond. James Bond.
I don't think that's your real name, sir.
It could be. You don't know.
I do, actually. I do.
Have you seen the documents?
Show me your birth certificate.
Alrighty then. I'll fax it right over.
You do that. That's Harold, for those who don't know. And also joining us via Skype from the wonderful state of Vermont.
Hi, I'm Morgan.
Show me your papers, sir.
We have not had a particularly snowy winter yet.
No, not at all. It's a shame. I know. We're. Yeah. I was trying to get together.
We haven't either, really.
No, it's. I think we had one measurable snowfall where it was more than say an inch, at least in my neck of the woods. Unpleasant.
Yeah, same here, and we've been going from like 50s to,
30s,
maybe 30. 20s.
Yeah.
So like we don't even have many freezing conditions.
And I put snow tires on the Jetta. I'm like, it seems like a waste now. I've been putting miles on the snow tires for really no reason. But
if you hadn't, we'd have gotten 3 feet.
True. And our final guest, the final person joining us on the show today is our guest all the way from Old Jersey in the United Kingdom is David Prittis. Hi, David.
Hi, how you doing?
Wonderful. Thanks for joining us on the show. David is an overland traveler, having visited 94 countries in about 4 years in his Defender 110. Did I get that right?
Yeah, you got that dead right. Yeah, spaced out over about 10 years. So on and off, working here and there, and then coming back and saving some more, and then heading off again. So, yeah.
Great.
Enjoying my global travels.
We will have a longer conversation with David later in the show. First, we'll get to the news. And before we get to the news, I do want to give you an update on our fellow contributor, David Carroll. He has had chemotherapy for his cancer, and he's expected to return home this week following some physical therapy. I saw a video of him today using a cane to walk around. So our continued thoughts to Dave and his family as he hopefully gets back to pulling winch cables and driving his Defender, hopefully, or his Disco very soon. And now we'll get into the news. First up is JLR sales for the U.S. in 2016 set an all-time record for them. They were up 24% increase over 2015. Some highlights, and this is from their press release, was that the JLR sold 105,000 units in the U.S., that's combined, Jaguar and Land Rover. Land Rover specifically, though, they sold almost 74,000 units, which is a 5% increase over 2015. And I actually did research for the show ahead of time, believe it or not. In the U.S., for 2016, there were 7.1 million vehicles sold. And so if you do the math, Land Rover has 1% of the American motor market.
How does that compare with their market share worldwide?
That is a good question. And I found an article on Forbes that had a breakdown of China, U.S., and Europe for Jaguar, Land Rover, and also the German marks of Audi, BMW, Mercedes. I'm not going to read all the numbers, but my kind of just reading things and looking at them, JLR in China sold a fourth of what each of the Germans sold, but their volume was up 30%, which is the best, which beat the German marks, who were up 5%, 11%, and 28%. In Europe, they were comparable in the volume that they sold, and they sold 200,000 units, whereas the Germans were selling almost 800,000 units, so they're about a, what's that, about a fourth. Did I do the numbers right? Yep.
Yes.
And they were, but they were still up 24%, and the Germans were up 7, 11, and 13%. In the U.S., JLR, as we mentioned, sold about 105,000 units, and they're up like 23, or was it, what, I forget the number already, like 23%. And the Germans, they were up 1%, down 10%, that's BMW, and up 3% in for Audi. They seem to be doing very well worldwide.
It sounds like they're gaining on the Germans.
Yes, especially here in the U.S. That's interesting. But and they seem to sell comparative to the Germans and the rest of the market. So whereas in China, the Germans are selling 400,000 to 500,000 units, and JLR sold about 105,000, 110,000 units. In the U.S., 200,000 to 300,000 units for the Germans and 105,000 for JLR. Europe is, as I said, 700,000 to 800,000. And they sold about 205, 210 in Europe. Interesting, the one that I kind of liked out of the reports and the breakdown of the details of the sales, the one that stuck out to me, as soon as I find a detail here, was the diesel-powered versions of the Range Rover and Range Rover Sport were up 15%. Or no, not up 15%. They were 15% take. So they were 15% of the sales for Land Rover in the U.S., which I think is very, very good.
That's really good. Did I hear somewhere that they were originally estimating that it was only going to be like 1 or 2% uptake?
Too bad there's not a podcast that talks about this stuff that would have that information and go back and check their records.
With an archive of back issues.
Yes, I think I think it was something like 2 or 3, maybe 5%, maybe, as I recall. I think you're right, Morgan.
Maybe Jeff brought that up last month, which was a really great show, by the way.
Thank you. That's very possible. So things that did very well for the brand in the sales side of the house here in the U.S. and around the world for the year. Disco Sport sold in the U.S. They sold 14,000 units, almost, 14 and a half. And I'll, another interesting stat we'd enjoy. The LR4 experienced strong demand in its final year, up 19% for the year of almost 11,000 units.
Yeah, the best way to sell something is to stop making it.
Yeah.
At least for Land Rover.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know about the other marks, but Land Rover does well in that regard.
VW regards the vans as well.
True. Very true.
For 35,000, saw one on the forecourt down the road the other day, like another manufacturer's taking one here in Europe. So if you want a 1974 like split screen lookalike, it's £34,000 these days.
Wow. That's roughly the going rate for a 74-88 Land Rover here in the U.S.
So things are looking well for JLR here in the States and I guess around the world, at least at the moment. So that's good. On the negative front, moving ahead in the news, JLR is under investigation for vehicle rollaways. A small number of Range Rover Evoque and Jag XF owners here in the U.S. Have reported that the vehicle has exhibited quote-unquote unintended motion after the car was put into park and the driver got out of the car. 4 complaints, there's the number, alleged that they have been injuries, one of which involved being pinned against a garage wall. So I guess there's a investigation being opened by NHTSA here in the U.S. Of course, Fiat Chrysler's already under investigation for that. And didn't that happen to the actor in the Star Trek movie?
Yes, it did. And what was his? Was his one of the...
It was a Range Rover, Jeep, wasn't it? Oh, no, it was a Jeep. It was a Jeep, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was a Jeep Wrangler or a...
Yeah, it was the Grand Wagoneer or something. I don't.
Yeah, something like that.
Too bad we don't have someone who knows about Jeeps to get him on the show. And explain them to me. I don't understand them. But yeah,
there, so that, there might be a podcast somewhere with some people that know that kind of stuff.
Yeah, maybe we should ask them about that. All right, moving on. Now, this article is from Automotive News, and it's mainly a Ford article, but there are Land Rover connections, which I think are interesting to note. The new turbo diesel engine coming next year in the Ford F-150 is already available in the U.S. in the Range Rover and Range Rover Sport. And I'm reading the article here. One lingering tie between Ford and Land Rover is powertrain. When Ford sold Land Rover and Jaguar to Tata in 2008. The new company relied on Ford for all of its engines. Many of those old connections are now broken since JLR opened its new engine plant in 15. That's the Ingenium engines for the four-cylinder diesel and gasoline. But Ford still provides V6 and V8 gasoline and diesel engines, including the 3-liter Lion V6 slated for the F-150. So I think that's in some ways probably good for Ford, actually, because that engine's has been tested and run around here in the States.
I was about to say, maybe you guys should take a look at it, because in the F-150, it's a gas guzzler. By the time Land Rover tinkered with it, it only does, 10 liters per 100 kilometers by the time they give it back to you.
What's a kilometer? Sorry.
It's 0.61 miles.
Ah, yeah. There we go.
That would equal about 21 to 23 miles per gallon, your money.
This article goes on to say that the Range Rover Sport, which has a 8-speed auto transmission, and of course drives all four wheels, delivers 32% higher overall fuel economy than the gasoline engine also available for an EPA-rated 28 mpg. And this article talks about how Ford wants to go after the diesel Ram industry, which I think currently gets 29, if this article's right, on the highway.
Well, the Ram is they've begun putting a diesel in their 1500, their half-ton truck, and that's what Ford's going after, because each of the manufacturers have had diesels in the past, but only on 3/4 and 1 tons. So they're trying to get diesel. They're trying to go after the half ton truck market, which is a big chunk of their market share already is half tons. So, but they have no diesel. So they're putting a diesel in their most popular truck, which is a good thing.
That is a very good thing.
Yep. And I guess it's expected to have that Ford F-150 is expected. Of course, you know, they've already moved it to an aluminum body, and it's going to have supposed to have a 10-speed automatic, which should help fuel economy and.
Well, it should help drivability too, because one of the things that's a detractor for diesel is that they don't rev. So by having more gears available, they don't need to rev the engine as much.
Interesting. As I said, there's still a tie there between Ford and JLR, and I guess it benefits both at this point.
Yeah, until the Ingenium really takes off, and then I assume that they'll, you know, start cutting ties there too.
I think that's part of their plan, isn't it?
Well, it only makes sense.
Yeah.
Staying on Ford, because I find this interesting, especially with the restyled new Defender coming in the next couple years, is that Ford's coming back out with the Ford Bronco, which I always saw as a kind of a competitor to the Defender in early Land Rovers, especially in what I'm calling the heritage market, if that makes any sense. So that's supposed to come out here, and maybe in 2020, it's going to be built alongside the Ford Ranger. And so it's probably going to be built on that platform. The last time they had the Bronco out, it was based off the F-150 pickup. And so folks are kind of excited by that it's coming out. I bring it up because, again, competitor, I don't know that Land Rovers, I'm sure they're aware, but there's going to be some, I think, competition for when the new Defender comes out for this, kind of a heritage segment.
Well, I think it's probably more of a direct competitor for Jeep, but either way, it's going to dilute the number of available buyers. And so in that sense, it's competition.
Right. And considering how small of a market share Land Rover has here in the U.S.
Right.
You know, it's not. I don't think it helps. It helps with the sales.
It's pressure. It's definitely pressure.
Yep. Now, it's interesting. I think one thing I read just the other day about it is that it's probably actually going to have solid axles. And I believe Jeep is actually moving away from solid axles, if I remember correctly. So that actually might really be much more competition for Jeep. We'll have to see what the Defender has.
Well, I guess maybe another way to look at it is that I don't know that Ford or Jeep considers Land Rover really a competitor, at least in this segment. It's probably the case.
Well, given the market share, they probably don't.
Yeah, right.
Yep.
Except for the high-end Range Rovers, right? Do they ever have the Bronco in the UK, David? Do you know?
No, we've never seen any of them over here. They'd have to be a special import.
Yeah, right. Okay. I'm just curious. Because
the full-size trucks here as well and other classic American cars are all one-off imports.
Right. Well, you're now just getting the Mustang. They started importing a Mustang, and I thought there was an F-150 available now in the UK.
Yeah, the right-hand drive thing makes an issue, though.
Well, that's what they did with the Mustang, is they actually switched it over to right-hand drive. Apparently, they're making a special export-import one.
Yeah, well, for anybody buying a brand-new one, for sure, but right. We have special laws here where if you import a classic or even a modern-day one, you're under no requirement to actually change the steering wheel. The traffic authorities are quite happy accepting that. You just have to change clocks. Well, obviously, clocks are fine, actually, because they're miles. But it's lights, things like that, just need to be changed.
Yeah, we're somewhat right. Similar.
Yeah, that's certainly the case here for the stuff that's 25 years old that we're importing. You don't really have to change much at all because it's exempt.
Yeah, we even exempt seatbelts for anything that old. Well, yeah, anything that didn't ship with seatbelts.
Right.
Interestingly, I think the original Bronco was imported. Well, one of them was imported into the UK for Land Rover to use as sort of a test vehicle when they were planning and developing the Range Rover Classic.
It would have been about the right period, mid-60s.
Yeah. I think it was while they were trying to decide on the suspension, because I believe the Bronco was using coil suspension.
Okay. I can't remember.
I can't remember either, but I think that's what they did.
The Broncos I've seen when I was in the States, they're all coil.
Yeah, well,
I think the later ones that were based on the F-150 were, but I'm not sure about the first generation Bronco, which was its own platform. I think it might have been at least coil front.
Right, it might have been coil front, so one of the first few that was doing coil front, and Land Rover just sort of used it as a test vehicle and just look at the competition for the market they were going into. And then, well, they decided to go full coil with the Range Rover.
And I think this new, in the article, they mentioned that the new Bronco might come from Australia, because it's apparently that's where the new Ranger's coming from also.
That's where all the cool stuff gets made these days anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really true. The Ranger is really popular in Australia, as are, well, they're still doing the Nissan Patrol and all of those. So.
All right.
And the Hilux. Obviously, we all drool over the Hilux.
Yeah. Well, careful with that. I wouldn't say all, but
that's one of the big drool factor vehicles for, at least for overlanders in the U.S.
I respect it. I don't drool for it.
Yeah.
Do we have a show name? I don't respect it. Or was it I don't drool over it?
I think that might be.
One of the latest Grand Tour, which is the replacement Top Gear, they just did the Range Rover. Did you guys see that this past weekend? I guess not.
I don't have Amazon.
Yeah, they took it. I have to say the show is, I think, okay, but this one I particularly enjoyed. I don't know if it's because there was a Land Rover in it, or if it was because I think it wasn't over the top like some of the last couple episodes have been. I haven't figured that part out. But they took the new Bentley Bentayga, May was driving that, and then all of a sudden the F-Pace shows up and a Range Rover shows up, and they took him and did some stuff with him, which was actually pretty fun to watch and pretty exciting to see. But the whole thing was that Jeremy kept saying, you can buy this really expensive, super expensive one, or you can buy the really, really cheap one, but we know what you're going to buy. You're going to buy the Land Rover. You're going to buy the Range Rover. It was kind of funny. I don't know where that came from. I have no idea why I brought that up.
Well, it's a good connection with the Range Rover.
Oh, that was it. That was probably why.
Yeah.
Speaking of connections, I don't know. I'm just moving on, I guess. Land Rover did a nice marketing thing again, and this time it was called The Letter with Love from Land Rover, a lifelong Land Rover fan, celebrated his 80th birthday. His name was Jeff, and they picked him up, took him for the Land Rover experience, and he got to drive the new Range Rover. And apparently he's known for going, having done rallies back in the day in a series truck, and he would wear a bowler hat. So they also gave him a bowler hat. I just, yeah, nothing more newsworthy than in a nice little marketing effort by Land Rover. Wow. Again.
Last time I saw a dude in a bowler hat, he was using it like a frisbee to decapitate statues.
Our friend of the show and former guest Mike Bishop was, I guess, part of that effort also.
Nice.
All right, moving on, and I think this one is going to elicit some conversation. So if you're not already sitting down and maybe you need a drink, you might be a good time to pause the podcast, get one, because I think we're going to talk a bit. This is from Architectural Digest. This is the last bit of the news, by the way. It's from Architectural Digest, and I'm going to do some reading, and then we're going to comment, and then I'll do some more reading, and then we'll do some more comments.
Not exactly the kind of magazine you'd turn to for your automotive stories, typically.
That's true, except they talk to Land Rover's chief creative officer, and he explains what goes into designing stylish cars. So Jerry McGovern, the design director and chief creative officer at Land Rover, they discussed selecting color, exterior design, and interiors, and they talked to him after the looks like the introduction of the 17 Discovery. So again, I'll read because I think the reading's important to get a sense of Jerry and his thinking, and then we'll comment on those. So that's how I plan to do this on making the Land Rover Discovery a style icon. One thing that's been missing from the Discovery, as much as it is liked, is that it's coming from a very functional base. People love the idea of its versatility. Its capability is a given. The trick is to make it more universally desirable without making it generic. That was a challenge with this vehicle, which, compared to the outgoing vehicle, is a massive shift. It's still got all the quality you'd expect and more. We create our vehicles within design, not the other way around, and the Discovery was no exception.
And I think, you know, as we've discussed numerous times, it is a fairly large change from what we are used to with the Discovery line.
I'm still working on the irony, if you will. Maybe it's hypocrisy, but talking about, you know, making it a style icon and without making it generic. And he's done exactly, well, he's made it generic.
Yes.
It's no longer iconic.
I completely agree. Thank you. That's exactly my thoughts too.
Yeah, other than that random throwback to the real inset tailgate, that's the only detail that's ever left on it.
Yeah, well, no, they do have a elevated roof. It's, I think, 3 millimeters, and they had a special ad all about how they have the raised roof in the back.
Yeah, they had to bring a straight edge and a micrometer to measure the roof raise. It's not there.
No one's going to notice it. It just looks like any other SUV. Soccer mom car now.
It looks like everything else they make, and that's the problem. And it's like, I mean, maybe it's still recognizable as a Land Rover, but it's not distinctively a disco anymore.
And it's
the first one I ever saw in real life. He drove past us at a coffee shop and someone else pointed it out to me. I didn't even recognize it as a Land Rover.
Wow.
Yeah, I think, you know, as we tend to say, it does look an awful lot like the Ford Explorer that we're used to seeing here. Yes, it's completely different size and stature, but that's the initial impression that you get when you see one.
Well, and if you're a fan of modern Range Rovers, you'll recognize that shape.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's the problem is that, you know, it's almost like it's diluted the value of the Range Rover design as well, because it doesn't stand out anymore either.
I wouldn't even say the design was the linking factor. The link, if you see it from a distance, it's the lights, that light cluster, sort of overlapping light cluster that they're all known for these days. That's the only discerning feature.
Well, they even changed that light cluster in the rear. You know, I always associated discos with having vertical lights, and now they've gone to horizontal lights, and the old ones had horizontal, and now they're on the vertical. And I'm like, it's just, you know, they were circular. Now they're just kind of a line, and then way too much LED going on. So I think all what we're all saying is what you started with, Harold, is
for you to say too much LED, John. That's saying something.
Oh, I don't even start it on LED lights on cars anymore. They're just, it's too much. It's slightly off topic, I know, but I was driving last evening coming home.
But you, everywhere, who previously was a serious lover of LED lights. Hmm.
I do love LED lights, but not too much. It's like outrageous anymore on the front end of cars, especially, you know, obviously I don't know about the rest of the world, but here in the US, they're just like massive bulbous light shows going on. Anyway.
Yeah.
But again, this is, I think everything we've said comes back around to what Harold said at the beginning is there seems like some hypocrisy here where you're saying the Land Rover Discovery was a style icon and you've kept it a style icon. And I don't think you have. You've done the opposite. You've made it generic. It was iconic before. Now it's generic. So.
Yeah. And, you know, Jeff brought up some interesting points last month on the podcast about when you're inside the new Discoveries, that they still feel very much like you're inside a Land Rover in terms of quality and, you know, the commanding position that you're in and all of that. But, you know, that's all well and good for the driver. But outside the vehicle is what Jerry is sort of saying he's preserved. And I don't see that.
And he hasn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, the native indigenous peoples of this continent would say he speaks with forked tongue.
Oh, but so as soon as you drive it in the rain and your foot doesn't get wet, I don't think it's a Land Rover anymore.
Well, yeah, there would be that. If you can't tell where it was parked.
Moving on to this is entitled On a Shift Toward Design. The fundamental change came when Tata bought JLR. Rattan Tata himself is trained as an architect. He was responsible for making sure that design was at the core of everything we do. One of the first questions he asked was, why does design report to engineering? Tata explained how design needed to be an entity in its own right. It changed straight away. That made a massive difference in the culture, particularly at Land Rover, which was about functionalism. Design was just seen as an addition. That was a fundamental shift. You can create design that still have engineering integrity. That's mutually compatible.
But on the other hand, I think it was a good thing. It was one of the things that made Land Rover special was that design reported to engineering as opposed to most companies where it's the other way around.
Yeah, I don't see as much of a problem with them being sort of, you know, on the same level but being separate.
Well, they do need to cooperate, and I think that, yeah, it's separate but equal and working together is a good thing. But, I mean, a lot of companies, they design and do the fashion stuff and the shape first, and then they hand it to the engineers and say, here, make something that works in this shape.
Right, and I'm not a big fan of that. And, you know, if – I mean, this is the Discovery we're talking about here and what Jerry is talking about. But if we sort of look back at Land Rover's history, I'll go back to the Range Rover Classic again. That's one that they designed, the engineers designed that for their mock-up vehicle, and they hired a designer to come in and redesign it for the final vehicle. And they looked at it and said, you guys came up with a great vehicle. I'm not going to change this. And they just did some like minor, like headlights and grill and stuff like that just to clean it up and make it look better. And that's been an extremely iconic design.
Well, yeah, it lasted same with the series. 27 years.
Right. Yeah. You know, and so
which is
Land Rover has a long history.
That puts Jerry out of a job, unfortunately. He likes the 5-year product life cycle because it gives him more to do.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, and this also shows that if Tata came in and said to move in this direction, that gives him that power to do that, as you said, Harold, and gives him a little more standing, and kind of does go against what we tend to think is the traditional Land Rover approach of build something functional, have it do its job, and then do the design and the creature comforts and all that stuff. But I think this clearly shows that Land Rover is moving away from that functionalism, and Jerry said it, and moving more to the design first. I'm a big, you know, big lover of design, and I enjoy great design. But also, I like it to be functional, and it should have a connection with the past, especially a vehicle product such as this. It should have that connection and they need to work better together. Maybe that's the point I'm going after.
Not only the vehicles being diluted in the practicality sense and just becoming more of a general family car, but also from getting away from that utilitarian use with all these bells and whistles and electronic gadgets on board, then the price just ever increases as well. And so they outprice themselves for any utilitarian market. You know, they want, you know, the Defenders were relatively cheap as a four-wheel drive went, and so they lent themselves well to people that needed to get out out in the sticks and, you know, chuck generators in the back and tools and all the rest of it. No one's going to be doing that with any of these modern line of vehicles because they've got leather interiors and, you know, different climate control aircon, which, you know, big hairy guys with work boots and like this are just going to wreck.
It's, right. Well, and that I've said all along that, you know, it's fine to do the fancy version with the leather and the electronics and stuff, but offer a version that's stripped down as well. I mean, once you've engineered the platform, it doesn't take that much work to develop a production product that's baseline, vinyl and rubber and, you know, nothing fancy.
And, you know, I think Land Rover is going to start seeing, or maybe they're already way too late to the game, competition in that area. I mean, you can now go see and that Mercedes has made huge strides in selling work vans. I mean, that's not really something I would have necessarily expected.
Well, I think the tale will be told, or whatever the phrase is, when they come out with the new Defender. We talked about this last month. What is the? Is there going to be a work version of that? Is there going to be a, you know, stripped down chassis that you can do anything you want, as has happened in the past with the Defender? You had that. Here's the cab. Now, you know, what do you want? An ambulance? Do you want a tow truck? Do you want, you know, whatever it is you need? Will that continue? And I think that goes to your point, all of your points of, you know, we're had the, that was the Defender was functionalism first and then design, and now we're moving to design. Are they going to have any of that? Is that function going to come with it?
If it was, there was a reason that it was square, it was because you tend to put square boxes in it.
Yes, exactly.
That's the very reason when you look at, say, the Ford Transit, even the new Ford Custom, you look in the back, it's a square box.
Or what's that, the new Fiat that over here is a Dodge? It's basically a square box. Yeah, you know, and it and right. And I, they're all over the place now.
Well, commercial vehicles are always square boxes, and for that very reason, because that's what you're going to put in them.
So have you seen the new Ford? I don't know whether you guys have it over there, but have you seen the Transit Custom?
We have the Transit and the Transit Connect. I'm not sure what the Transit Custom is.
It's a small version of their full size Transit van. So the Ford Connect was more like a car body, wasn't it?
And then it's like a tall car or a square box car.
Yeah. So the traditional large Transit was more like, you know, the big aerodynamic wedge, you know, typical van front body continued all the way to the back.
Yeah, which is still kind of a compact van over here, by the way.
Yeah. Well, now we've got even more compact ones with like great gas mileage and but still a very square interior, but they've chucked some interesting styling at it. Just give it a Google and have a look at it. And they've actually made quite a stylish van.
So it's sort of a mid-range between the Transit and the Connect then?
Yeah. And it's hugely popular here in Europe.
Okay. Because
obviously, it's all the latest, you know, whiz-bong gadgetry regards the EU laws and the fuel emissions and everything. But it's fast, it's powerful, it's small. And so the delivery companies and the builders and the painters and everything are eating it up because it's easier to park. It goes further for less money. It's actually been a huge success here. And I'm already seeing a lot of people that were having, say, four-wheel drives looking at it as well as like a lightweight camper van. Because they come with a fairly decent bit of ground clearance as well.
That would be an opportunity for Ford over here because they gave up the minivan market a long time ago. Well, because the minivan they had was positively awful.
It was horrible.
So this would be an opportunity to get back into that world.
Yeah, and I've seen a lot of people with the whole – it's, you know, related to overlanding, the whole van life scene. A lot of people are picking up Sprinters and the Ford Transit vans and all of those and converting them into RV, recreational vehicles. And that hasn't taken off quite as much in the U.S. I think it's starting to. But
well, overlanding vehicles in general haven't really caught on in the U.S. yet, but they're just starting to.
Right. Absolutely. And there in the U.S., there are very few that are four-wheel drive capable.
Four-wheel drive vans of any sort are hard to get.
Yep.
Mercedes do a good line of them. And the VW do the Synchros. And Invecchia still do them as well. Yeah.
Just hard to get here. That's the problem.
Well, for BMW and Mercedes, both still in the U.S., are considered like luxury models. you know, luxury brands similar to Land Rover, at least here. So usually you don't get those standard everyday cars like, you know, Ford.
The working man models.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah,
they're starting to take off here. Mercedes especially is starting to really push their working class vehicles.
They sold Sprinters for quite a while through their commercial truck division, which is Freightliner.
Yep.
Well, and that's – and, you know, the Fiat side, who owns Chrysler here, they're doing this kind of a similar thing with rebranded, as mentioned earlier, right. The Dodge. All right. Well, let's move on to another paragraph on a cultural awakening at Jaguar Land Rover. It was an awakening for the business to think that way. The Evoque was the first vehicle I was responsible for, that vehicle that was a white space vehicle. It didn't exist before. It came from the idea of taking a luxury SUV and making it smaller, targeted partly toward more female drivers.
In other words, the opportunity to make the ultimate Freelander.
We thought we'd sell maybe 20,000 or 30,000 of them. On average, we've sold 125,000 a year for 5 years in a row now. We never had to put any money into it in terms of marketing. It's been a massive success. Through design, we could create desirability. Once technology had become comparable throughout the industry, what are you left with? It's your brand, and it's the design. Here's my comment. This goes back to the previous one, too, to the previous paragraph. He said it there, but in a different way. Cars are commodities. The actual building of it, anybody could do that, and it's kind of been figured out, and you can kind of – and so the design, what it looks like and how it functions and what it does for you and what it takes, what you can take with it, is now what differentiates the vehicles from themselves. And I think Jerry's said that's – I think it's where we are in cars. They are just – they're a commodity, you know, and the ability – until something major happens again, I think they're all pretty much comparable under the skin, and the design is what's going to make you stand out. I'm not saying I'm for or against it. It's just I think that's what he's saying, and I think that's something I've seen also in the industry.
Although, I mean, I got to say that in this context, the vehicle he's talking about in this case, the Evoque, is actually the most distinctive thing he's penned for Land Rover.
Yeah, it's really true. He, you know, it's sort of was squeezed into a place that didn't exist in their lineup, and the other models are now sort of taking all their design aspects from them or from it.
And well, because it worked, so he's going to roll that into everything else.
Right. And, you know, I would actually go the other direction, that we're at a point in vehicle design, and we've been on this path for a while now, where things are starting to, especially because of safety and fuel efficiency laws in the US and Europe and all around the world, that vehicles are becoming much more similar in their design. So yes, design can help them stand out, but for a lot of it, it's the functionality that you don't find in different models that makes people choose them.
Well, that's where the technology kicks in that they put on the vehicle.
Right.
Yeah, that then starts to be your differentiator.
Well, that's where engineering comes into play.
Exactly.
The part he doesn't think is important.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the things that actually probably has done well for the Evoque, is that it had the technology from Land Rover to make it a versatile off-road vehicle. It really is not quite as oversimplified and weakened as John, the Freelander was initially.
Careful.
I know, trying to be careful.
It was a chance to right some wrongs with the Freelander, maybe.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, the problem with the Freelander was reliability. It was not capability. It was reliability.
And honestly, that was the situation with Land Rover. It was also the situation Ford and, you know, all of that.
Well, so, especially with Land Rover.
Yeah. But I do think that some of the technology in the vehicle, in terms of functionality, is really what tends to set them aside or set them apart. Yes, somebody's going to go and say, oh, well, I want a Range Rover. Here's an affordable Range Rover. It looks stylish. But when they go and test drive it, they can go and pick a whole bunch of other all-wheel drive SUVs, and they're probably going to find that the Evoque actually performs better than most of the other comparable all-wheel drive SUVs out there.
And it's a Range Rover, so they get that right. status also.
Right. So I'm afraid he might misattribute some of that ease of selling it to the design, when part of it is just the name and part of it is that functionality that once you get in it and drive, you can sort of go anywhere.
I think in the sense that, you know, maybe he is partly right in that, you know, that people may be attracted to Range Rover but think it's too big of a vehicle. So by styling one that's, mm-hmm. you know, cute looking and it's still a Range Rover,
smaller
but it's
version.
Smaller. And for the people who are intimidated by trucks, it's more of a gateway Range Rover, if you will, gets people into the brand.
Agreed.
I think what you have to ask yourself is that in 20 years' time, like, will people, you know, be taking those things and trialing them and taking them actually off-road or stripping them down and having fun with them? I doubt that. I think most of them will either be scrapped or they'll just be general run-around bangers. It's not like, you know, what people do with Range Rovers or the earlier Discoveries or even the older series. They keep going on. They keep getting reinvented. And I can't really see where Land Rover is going with its longevity, because the vehicles they have got a short shelf life. And I just don't see, like, an Overlander in 20 years' time, when they do become cheap and available and plenty of them hanging about, ever taking on something like that or trying to convert it.
I don't think any of them will be still on the road 30 years hence, like the old stuff is, definitely.
Well, I think
just by nature of the way the platform is engineered, I don't think you can. I don't think it'll last.
And I think that's true of many vehicles.
Well, absolutely. But that's what made a Land Rover a Land Rover, is that you could keep it going for 50, 60, 70 years.
I think you've hit on something that I've thought about for a while but have not voiced is – you know, Land Rover is changing how it's doing things, and that's clear, and this is highlighting that. But I think it's moving, and you guys have talked all around it, of there was longevity, somewhat reliability, and now there's less of that longevity. Granted, it's probably more reliability, but, you know, there's the five-year cycle.
I think they've made a corporate culture shift towards planned obsolescence.
To the point of they want to sell more vehicles. And to sell more vehicles, people need a reason to sell more vehicles. So if that vehicle only lasts 5 years and then throw it away, then they can get another one. So I think that's what you're seeing here is this dedicated shift to, yeah, it's great. And they support heritage, and they certainly seem to, and there's all those vehicles out there, but they're trying to appeal to newer people. And that's as evidenced by the fact that sales are up worldwide. So I think that strategy, while we may not like it, I think that's the strategy is, you know, sell more cars and they're only going to last for a while. And the heritage people don't buy new cars. They're not buying new cars. They're buying the old cars and keeping them going. And Land Rover doesn't make any money off of that.
And I think that's actually a really important point, because Land Rover is in a very unique situation. I mean, there are some other marks that have this, but that there are so many people who want the current expensive, fancy Land Rovers, but there are also so many people who are willing to pay the same amount, if not more, and in most cases, a lot more, for the old version, the very old version that's, you know, 20 years old.
Certainly on this continent, that's how it works.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that's one of the reasons they opened up their heritage restoration service, so that, and then now they can make money off of that, right?
I would say that's a good bet.
Yeah. Why don't we move on in the article here? We'll have plenty of opportunity to continue our conversation.
Back to more pearls of wisdom from Clueless Jerry.
I love that segue. On design is not a democracy. The kiss of death is designed by committee. I'm not going to explain to the chief engineer how suspension systems work or tell the chief financial officer how to do his accounts. What Tata has brought is an incredibly liberating way of working. People are more accountable. You're in charge of your own destiny. You fail. That's encouraged from the start. Moving on a little bit to the next paragraph here. One of the problems Jaguar has had for a long time is that they were seen as too is a bit too retrospective rather than looking forward. Land Rover has a unique heritage, but it's about recognizing that heritage. I think the Land Rover brand lends itself to all types of white space opportunities. You look at the SUVs. By 2020, there will be about 25 million products sold on an annual basis. That's a massive opportunity to do something special.
Okay, so do something special, Jerry.
And I tend to really worry about dilution of the brand and the design when it comes to looking at a company like Land Rover and saying, look at all this white space, let's fill it in.
Well, I get creating some market space because you market, you know, a car, different models, because there's an opportunity there and you think you want to fill it, and you can sell a car in that market, like the, you know, the Range Rover coupe, you know, two-door get. I get that. I think the thing here that I want to, because you want to sell more cars, you know, that's obviously what they want to do. That's their job. But the thing that, right, that stands out to me in this paragraph here was Land Rover has a unique heritage, but it's about recognizing that heritage. I don't see it, Jerry. I think that's the point here.
Yeah, and he talks about white space, and, you know, he just loves that word apparently, but, you know, the opportunity to do something special. Well, yeah, his idea of filling in that white space is to get out his templates and keep tracing.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go at this from the design aspect as well, that in design, negative space or white space is just as important as, you know, whatever you've drawn or created or structured. So, you know, it's filling in too much of that is not helpful. And when it comes to the vehicles themselves, getting back to the point you made, John, that you could, you know, simplify, or maybe this was Harold, you know, simplify the vehicles to make less expensive models. They could do that with the new Discovery 5, and it's got a ton of cargo space in it. You could make a pretty nice vehicle that could be quite utilitarian without having to change much of your production process.
Well,
I agree. I don't think they're willing to do that anymore.
What? That's an opportunity there that they're going to waste, I'm sure.
Right.
Well, this all, I think, is going to inform the new Defender coming up. And I think that's one of the reasons I wanted to bring this article up. Well, yes, it was an Architectural Digest, but it gives an insight into Jerry's thinking and how he views the company and how he views design and where it fits. And I think that we should all be prepared for, I think, a Defender that does not fit any of our expectations.
Well, and keep in mind that Architectural Digest is really just an art magazine.
Right.
And there's never any actual architectural content in Architectural Digest.
Well, but the Defender is art. I'm the first to say that, you know, I find the Defender to be art itself.
I agree, but without some engineering and architecture, if you will, behind it, it's nothing.
Exactly. But
it's lines on paper.
But that's why you need to. But anyway, but this article, I think, you know, gives you a sense of Jerry and how his thinking is, and the chief design, was he the chief designer, chief creative officer? That vehicle's coming, and it's already been designed, and I think we know what it's going to look like. So,
yeah, and since we don't like anything else he has to say, we probably won't like what he's drawn.
Prepare yourself is what I'm trying to say.
I'm already prepared. It's going to be clueless.
Well, it's just going to be another one in a boring lineup. It's like I just sent you guys a picture there for like reference of the whole lineup of the current models. And it's just a side-on shot, and you see same sort of thing, big 19-inch alloys, a couple of lines through the car, a few little details that sort of go from one to the other, with the type of the headlights, this, that, and the other. To be honest, if any one of those cars went past you at 90 mile an hour, you wouldn't know which one it was.
Right.
Which is, well, and to prove to your point, I was coming back from Overland Expo, and I drove by this vehicle, and I thought it was an Audi. Turned out it was the very first Jag F-Pace I've ever seen in the wild. First, I thought it was an Audi when I came upon it.
Well, you can't blame Jerry for that one.
True. But, hey, same company. I'm sure he had some influence.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure they talk at lunch, if nothing else.
So, dear listeners, if you have comments on this particular topic, we're certainly open to hear them. Feel free to send us an email or tweet us or put it on the Facebook page, and we'd like to hear what you have to say about the upcoming Defender or about Jerry's, the chief creative officer, and how he views vehicle design and functionality.
Chief Creative Officer. Isn't that just a spiffy sounding name?
And that's the news. We'll be back after this short break for the rest of the podcast. Welcome back to the Center Steer Podcast. This is the January 2017 show. It's number 46. And this month, our very special guest is David Pertis, who is an overland traveler. He has visited 95 countries in the last 10 years. That, if you have been paying attention on the podcast, that number has gone up by one since we started the podcast, because he checked his rechecked his numbers and realized it was 95.
Maybe he dashed out for a quick trip during the break?
It's very possible. And he's been traveling in a Defender 110. And to go out, of course, I have links to all of his web presence in the show notes. But if you want to, if you're at your computer right now, listener, and you want to check him out, go to Lost Horizon on Facebook. That's LostHorizon to track all of his travels and things. David, welcome to the show. And so tell us about, you know, of course, we're a Land Rover podcast, so tell us how you've been getting around on those to those 95 countries.
Oh, well, my now semi-famous Land Rover Goliath, he's got quite a fan following of his own. I think if I put more pictures up of him, I get more hits per page than if I bother doing a selfie or anything like that.
That is true.
Well, so, I'd rather look at pictures of 110s than people, so.
There you go. Yeah, draw factor.
Does Goliath have its own webpage?
It doesn't actually. I've sort of followed a few other overlanders that have gone with the vehicle persona and followed it and sort of seen how it does. And I don't know. Some have met quite good success. There's an Australian guy that has Colonel Mustard. I don't know whether you've come across that on the web. And he has like his own Instagram page and stuff like that. And he sort of speaks in the first person from the Land Rover point of view of where he took his occupants today and stuff like that. So it can be quite funny, but I've just kept it more about the landscapes and the Land Rovers and just making everybody else jealous that they want to be there.
I think it'd be difficult to do that first-person perspective thing without it becoming stupid in a hurry.
Yeah, I think that's why I lost interest as well. It got a bit childish after a while. Once the initial...
It's cute once in a while, but if you try to maintain... Yeah, exactly. It's cute for a little bit, and then you get tired of it.
Yeah, one of our listener, Vasily, has a Instagram for his truck. Which one is that? Is that LR Blue, I think? But yeah, he does. He basically...
Little Blue Landy or something?
Little Blue Landy, I think that is it. And he'll take pictures on its journeys and travels and post them. It's just, but they're just pictures, you know, nothing, not a first person, you know, not witty or childish.
Yeah, if you don't do the cute narrative, it's okay. Just pictures, it's good.
Yeah. So there we go. Consider Goliath getting its own. So tell us more about Goliath. What exactly is it?
Yeah.
When is it?
Why do you name it Goliath?
You know, the famous Greek fable, David and Goliath.
Yeah, but correct me if I'm wrong, because I don't remember the story all that well. But doesn't David kill Goliath in that story?
Well, I find that it's quite a good analogy in the sense that you could just take one bolt out of it from one particular critical place and you could kill it.
But I'm not sure I'd want to be driving something that could be destroyed by one well-placed stone.
Taking plenty of stones out of that chassis over the years. But
exactly.
Not quite killed it. So, yeah. Dented it, perhaps, but not killed it.
Well, so, dents are okay. Those are beauty marks.
Yeah.
So what year is it?
It's a 2006 TD5110.
Ooh, and it's in alabaster white, is it not?
You know, more than me. I thought it was Arctic white.
Oh, I don't know. I thought that was alabaster, but okay.
White is white. Come on.
It's that nice off-white.
It's just white.
It's generally white with a splattering of mud, usually.
Perfect. Perfect. How many miles you got on it?
156,000 now.
Oh, so it's just broken in.
I think the engines are good for 200,000 without a rebuild. This one's doing remarkably well, considering that, you know, it doesn't do the shopping run. It's, you know, it's been on in deserts in plus 45 and it's been down to like minus 20 and everything. Oh,
so I think that's probably a 300,000 mile engine, to be honest.
Oh, fingers crossed.
Unless you take care of it properly. I mean, if you beat the hell out of it and neglect it, yeah, then 200,000. But take care of it, it should be good for three.
Well, I'll go for the three then, because he gets well looked after. Oil changes every 10 in the engine. All the gear oils and wheel bearings are always re-greased every 20,000 miles. So.
Great. How did you get into Land Rovers? Or was that Goliath your first one?
No, I actually I learned to drive on the beach in a 1972 Series 3.
Right on.
And I had a summer job with, like, hiring deck chairs and sunbeds, and this was the work vehicle. And so when we had overcast days where there weren't many people around, but you always had to be there just in case someone wanted to hire something. So I used to take the poles out of a windbreak and make a parking bay on the beach and then practice my parallel parking with the Land Rover with no power steering.
Nice. Yes. We've all done that, but not on a beach. Yeah.
Well, a beach. Well, the good thing is, if you messed up, you just knocked the pole over.
Exactly. It's our TV course.
And that was your learning to drive.
Yeah, that was my learning to drive. And then when I actually went and had some, because that was before I was legal to drive here in the UK. And then when I actually went and done some lessons and stuff, my parking instructor asked me to park a really small hatch. Like, you know, typical town car. I just done it with one hand and just looked over my shoulder, and he was just flabbergasted as a learner driver, just to park it in one.
Well, yeah, you're wondering what to do with that other hand because you don't need it for the steering.
Exactly, yeah. I'm not trying to haul around a massive, like, you know, 19-inch wheel which wants to fight you back with the slack in the steering.
So what was your first overland trip? Was that in in Goliath, or had you had something before?
I had a 93 TDI 200 110, but this one was van body. And I bought that towards the end of my time in mainland UK when I was at university. And I brought that back to the island, and it was a bit of a doer-upper. So it needed a lot of work and sorting out, but mechanically it was generally sound. And then I kitted that one up, and I'd done a one-year tour of Africa. So I left Europe over on the ferry to Morocco and came all down the west coast to South Africa and then up through the central and east Africa back up to Ethiopia and Djibouti. And that took me a year. Yeah.
And I think you have a dedicated Flickr account for all those photos.
Well, Flickr and things like that didn't exist back then. I took a trusty, I had a couple of film cameras, which I didn't end up using a great deal because digital had just come along, and the amazing megapixels are 3.4 megapixels.
Right. So
a lot of those pictures sort of remain on the hard drive these days. They just don't really have the quality that we're used to now.
Right. So you took a year, and you took that 83 110 then, and were you by yourself? Any interesting adventures? Did you have any breakdowns or meet any interesting folks along the way?
Oh, plenty. Yeah, there's plenty of side stories I can talk about. The vehicle was originally set up for two, me and my then girlfriend, and she bailed on me about 3 months before we were set to leave. Had a bit of a freak out. I can't go to Africa. The spiders are too big. Whatever this was.
In other words, you showed her what she was going to be traveling in.
Well, she knew that when she bought into it a few months before, but I don't know what she expected me to do with it, like rebuilding it at the time, but it's still a Defender at the end of the day when you're going to leave. So.
She took one look at this and said, that's it. I'm done. I'm out.
No, I think it was she's always a bit of a warrior. I think it was more to do with, like, the security situation and stuff like that, and the vulnerability of being in foreign languages, and not always being able to speak the language, and, you know, being unsure of the situation. And there was other things going on in the world at the time, like I think it was the first invasion of Iraq, so it didn't make many members of the Western world, including Britain, supporting America in the invasion, popular in the Muslim parts of North Africa.
So this is what, 1991, 90?
Yeah. Well, no, not that. About 2003, 2004.
Oh,
I think.
Okay.
Maybe it was the second invasion.
That would be the second. Yeah. Yeah.
That would be the second coming. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, the second time round when they went back to finish him off. So, we weren't exactly the flavour of month in England.
So you end up going on your own then?
I did. Yeah, I set off on my own and met lots of cool people and met other overland travellers, which I travelled with a Dutch couple through Western Africa for about 6 weeks with, until they turned chicken and went on a ship down to Namibia, and I've then drove through Nigeria, Cameroon, Gabon, the Congos, that way, generally on my own, but then teamed up with a nutty overland truck driver, Australian overland truck driver, who they'd made a mess up with their punters and their visas, and they'd end up having to fly all the customers out from the overland truck in Angola, and then he was sent back to basically recover the truck and drive it on through the Congos and get it back to the... I think the base was in Ushuaia in Kenya, I think.
All right, so you took a 1 year journey through down Africa and back up again. Did you get to South Africa?
I did, yeah.
Because you know, we have friends of the show who are currently in the U.S. Graham and Louisa Bell, you know, are from South Africa. I just not that you would have come across them, but I just mentioned the connection.
Their first book. We're on the second one now.
Ah, good deal. Yeah, good for you. Yeah. They're, I think the last I saw, the 110 is about to be rebuilt. They cut the back end off from the first door back. So anyway.
Well, if you read it first, then I have a cameo part about finding them a spare tire in Ushuaia when we're there at the tip of South America.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Oh, you should reread the book then.
I guess I didn't put the two together, but there you go. There's a gem for podcast listeners. The world is indeed small, is it not? So you guys show up in the book.
A typical classic Land Rover, well, not just Land Rover, but Overlander meeting. And Land Rover parking calls applied in the car park in Ushuaia. I just rolled up. I saw this 130 there, all tooled up, you know, with shiny bits of it and rooftop tents there. And I go, that's been places, like looking at the battle scars and whatnot. So I pull up and park next to it. And of course, we don't know each other. So we're just wandering around the shops doing our thing. And then they came back, obviously spotted me parked next to them. And they were just busy leaving me a note about where they were staying when I rocked up with my shopping as well. So then we started chatting, ended up sharing accommodation in Ushuaia, getting very, very drunk together. For a few days, and then they told me about their tire woes, which is a big, long, complex story. But ultimately, they were in desperate need of a new Land Rover rim and ideally a tire to fit it. And I'd been meeting a classic car group on and off coming down through the southern half of South America, and their support vehicles were three Defender 110s. And so they were actually in Ushuaia shipping the classic cars and the support vehicles out. So I knew all the people, so I just arranged and lined up the dots, and we were lucky enough to catch the Defenders literally as they were rolling them in the containers, and we unbolted a spare wheel straight off the back door and gave the guys some cash for it, and made very, very happy.
Outstanding. That's good.
That's awesome.
That tire story is quite the saga, although now apparently they have corporate sponsorship from Falcon, so it's taken a different turn.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, hopefully it's moved away from those 15-inch rims, which caused him a lot of grief. But anyway.
Yeah. Any other interesting stories from that journey? Like, how long when you got back after that trip, did you keep the vehicle, or did you get a different one, or what did you learn even from that journey?
Well, I learned from that journey that I loved overland travel. It was the first big overland trip. There was a lot of firsts in the sense of the countries I was going through, some of the languages I had to deal with, obviously overland border crossings, and also dealing with corrupt police and officials and all sorts of fun paperwork. So it was a huge learning curve to the point where I was hunted down by some of the said officials one night in Nigeria, which was quite the eye-opener. And turned into quite an epic hiding story. So to give you the background, Lagos is the Delta Strip along the southern side of Nigeria is just like carjacking hell. And because of all the Western workers there related to the oil industry, it's also top 10 territory for kidnapping Westerners and then ransoming them back to the oil companies they work for. So I wanted to avoid that southern part and go north. And I'm not sure if you're aware, but Nigeria has a very sort of religious split through the country. So it's more Muslim in the north and more Christian in the south. And ironically, because of the tough laws the Muslims put in place, the Sharia law, people are kept better in check in the north. So I fancy my chances better at getting through the north without any incident than the south. And to that end, I drove 500 miles north in the next neighboring country, Benin, and crossed over a very small and little remote jungle border post. And when I got to the Nigerian side, yeah, everything works out there on Africa time. So nothing happens terribly quickly or fast. And we're just moseying along through the paperwork and chatting where you're from and blah, blah, blah. And I think, okay, everything's going cool. We're not a problem. We'll get through the process. And then towards the end of the getting the final stamps and this, that, and the other, as they're about to release me from the border area, I realize what they've been up to, and it's all been a delaying tactic. And the sun's going down, dusk is on us. And these guys knew that overlanders don't generally like driving at night, and especially not off-road and with large animals like we have in Africa prowling about. It just makes things slow and difficult, and it's all too much like hard work. You want to be, you know, set camp and having a sundown, and by the time the actual sun dips over the horizon. So they were hoping I wouldn't drive very far at all. And but on the grapevine, I'd heard this was a typical ploy, and then knowing that you wouldn't go very far, they'd come out and rob you in the night. And of course, these guys have guns and everything like that legally. And so when I rolled into the neighboring town, I got a really uneasy feeling. Everyone was looking at the vehicle, and you know, it was literally like, oh, we'll have those tires, and oh, I'm sure there's some shiny things in the back. And I was like, right, I've just got to put distance between me and them, because there was only one road through this jungle. You couldn't like mix it up and try and lose them in a multitude of routes. So the only thing I could do was just drive and drive and drive, and it was really slow going and hard work off road, all into the thing. And I put down 100 miles that night and ended up pulling over about 12 o'clock at night and reversing the vehicle back into the jungle and completely camouflaging it up. And I mean, completely going to town. Like dark T-shirts turned inside out over the headlights so that they wouldn't reflect, bedsheet over the window screen, loads of bushes cut down, thrown all over the car, things like that. It was just completely camouflaged. And so I slept in the back rather than putting the rooftop tent open that evening. And it all paid dividends, because about 4 o'clock in the morning, this ute comes along with two guys in the back with AKs and spotlights searching the bushes either side trying to find me. And yeah, my heart was in my mouth, and I knew that it was a real serious game at this point. And luckily my camouflage paid off and they didn't find me.
Wow. Wow.
And yeah, that's the only word for that.
Yeah. Wow. So I take it you then waited a bit and were able to get out of the situation there and without a further incident.
Well, the awkward thing was that I was still on that singular road until I got to this town down the road, which then had junctions and stuff. So I knew I'd have to cross paths with them again the following morning. But I was banking on the fact that it was market day down the road. So once there's too many witnesses around, they can't then, you know, rob you and shoot you in broad daylight with too many witnesses. There's too many people to pay off, even by Nigerian standards. So you've got that protection from being in the public environment. So I actually saw them sat on a street corner cafe and literally sort of ran down the window, said hi to them, and then belted on the corner and continued on my way and didn't look back.
So maybe your girlfriend knew something, huh?
Yeah, well, you know, I didn't get shot, so... just chalk it up to experience.
And you made it back home then without further incident?
No, there's plenty of other interesting stories of different characters you meet and ways of talking the way out and other stuff, like just with, you know, things that happen with you off-roading in the middle of nowhere, getting yourself stuck or, you know, bogged or the odd serious breakdown, like what sounds like a typical simple one, you know, fan belt breaks, but when you're in 45 degrees of heat in the Sahara Desert, you can't continue, even though there's no fan running. So, you know, having to get underneath the car in that sort of heat, plus the engine heat radiating or changing that out, And I foolishly left my spanner in the sun as well and burnt my hand when I went and picked it back up to reuse it. And
That's a rookie mistake.
Exactly, yeah. Well, that's coming from a British pilot. You can leave things out and expect them to get rained on, not turn into, you know, red-hot pieces of steel.
How long then till you? How long did you have that vehicle? That was at the 83, right? And then you picked up the current 06. How'd that occur?
Well, when I came back, I knew I wanted to do more overland travel, but I was in that position where I was going to have to work and save again for a while. So I rolled with the idea back and forth for quite some time. That was that older Land Rover that now had something like 180,000 miles on it. And hard miles as well, of course, even after its rebuild in Africa. Was it worth reinvesting in, or was it better to buy a newer vehicle and then get that one overland specced up and then really be able to utilize that throughout the rest of its life? And I decided at that point Land Rover were just coming to the end of their TD5, so all the bugs and things have been ironed out, and they were talking about, you know, the TD V6. And that was a whole unknown element going into, you know, converted transit engine, really. And so I thought it was a good time to buy a good sturdy Defender straight off the shelf and then spec that up into an overland vehicle and then be able to use that for the years going forward. And so that was the point I bought the new TD5 and sold on the 200.
And then what was the first journey you took with the new Defender, or newer Defender, new to you?
Yeah, it was Tunisia, actually. It was a bit of a shakedown trip for it. It was still very much green. I borrowed a roof rack off a friend and made some sort of makeshift storage and bits and bobs in the back to get us going. And I took myself and two friends for a tour of Tunisia right down to the Egre Occidental on the edge of the Sahara. And it was also doubled up as a bit of a scouting trip for what I was hoping was going to be a future trip into Libya, because this was before it all descended into the mess it now is. And so I wanted to check out how long it took us to get across Europe down to Genoa, and then we took a 24-hour ferry across the Mediterranean, and then also to suss out how good the coastal road was to sprint down the coast of Tunisia and reach the Libyan border. But unfortunately, that Libyan trip's never been pulled off since because of history moving on.
So how often do you go out? Like, so you've been doing this for, well, now it's been 10 years, right? And you've been in 94 countries. Do you go out every year? Do you go out for a year? What's the general plan?
There's never been any particular pattern. Like, Africa was, you know, a one-year thing on itself, and then I worked and saved and also paid the TD5 off for another 5 years before launching on my next big trip, which was we went up through Northern Europe up to Finland, and then crossed through Russia, and that was all through the top of Asia. So it was like Russia, Kazakhstan, Russia again, Mongolia, then crossed China to Southeast Asia. And then I was at this point where the original plan at that point was to then ship out and go on to Australia and live and work there for a while. But then various factors changed that, and I shipped to North America instead, into Los Angeles, and then drove inland to the Rockies, and then followed the Rockies all the way up through and on into Canada, and followed that Icefield Parkway right north into right up to Yellowknife, really, and then turned and went up through the Yukon and on into Alaska, and then that was following the Pacific coast all the way back down, generally.
When did you do that trip?
Well, straight after the Asia one, so that was like back to back. I just took a month out while the Land Rover shipped across the Pacific. I timed that around Christmas, so I could fly back, spend Christmas with the family, and then pick up the Land Rover in the new year. I think the year was, actually. I just saw my notes on that one, so it all goes into a blur some days.
True, I can imagine. Okay. So, and you drove all of that throughout North America and through Russia? That was all?
Yeah, all driven in the same TD5.
Nice. Have you seen, I'm sure you're familiar with Ewan McGregor taking that, what was the name of that?
Long Way Around.
Long Way Around. So you was that a similar path or similar, was a different path? Sounds like you went more north, and I think he was kind of more south Russia, but as I recall. But it was like a similar experience, I guess?
No.
No.
My route crossed with theirs in a couple of places, but I took quite different routes to theirs. Like, for instance, when I crossed from Finland into Russia, that was so that we could see St. Petersburg. They never went anywhere near St. Petersburg. They crossed from Belarus, went through Moscow, and then kept to the south, which is the Trans-Siberian Highway, basically, that runs along the southern side of Russia. And whilst I followed that down, well, went down to Volgograd, and then from Volgograd down to Astrakhan, and then Astrakhan takes me into Kazakhstan, they only skipped through the top edge of Kazakhstan for a very short time, where I literally drove Kazakhstan from the western border to the eastern border before then turning north and coming back up into Russia. So very different routes there. And then from there through to Lake Baikal, that would have been a similar route to theirs. But then I turned south into Mongolia, where I think they came through the Altai region instead. I done that as like a separate loop and then came back up. And then they never carried on into China. They went up to, you know, Magadan and the Bona roads and all that way to far eastern Russia. I turned south and, you know, went Mongolia, China that way. So
you were traveling alone, but you were traveling with others at this time, right?
I initially set off with a couple of friends up through Europe and into Russia, but then they wanted to continue on the Trans-Siberian Railway. So.
No camera crew? You didn't have a camera crew with you on that one?
No. There was funny talks, actually, with a production agency early on when we were sounding the idea, but in a way, the space was a bit flooded with stuff, and obviously the whole reason that Long Way Round and then Long Way Down and all that got focus was because obviously there's a Hollywood related actor, you know, taking on it. They weren't really interested from, you know, a boy and his Land Rover from Jersey. So
I don't understand why not.
I'm talking to the right audience for that, but obviously
yes, you are
the TV production crew audience. So
indeed, that's right. Is that your most recent journey?
No. The most recent one was shipping out of Australia to Chennai in India, and then 2 months in India, crossing Pakistan, and then on into Iran. Massive tour of Iran, at least over a month, about 6 weeks, but really right across the country. And then on into Turkey, covered a lot of ground in Turkey also, and then up through Greece and then Europe and up through the Balkan states, really. And some of its more recent checkered history as well.
So it sounds like the only continent you've not been to is South America.
No, done South America.
No, it was there.
Oh, jeez.
Did you not hear the tire story?
Oh, that's right. I thought that was Africa. I'm sorry.
That's why I was the tip of South America.
Yeah. Putting it all together now, I'm sorry.
So Antarctica is the continent.
Yeah, that's the continent. I haven't quite earned my Expedition 7 badge yet. I need to get Goliath to Antarctica.
Yeah. You know, so far after 46 episodes, we've only had one guest who has been to Antarctica.
And he's been there three times.
But to be fair, I felt the Expedition 7 one was a bit of a cop-out. Like, whilst one of the Land Cruisers got there and they drove it around on the edge of the continental shelf, it wasn't the vehicle they drove to the pole.
You've been to 94 countries, which I'm not going to ask you to name them all because you've done a pretty good job, I think, of naming many of them.
95, actually.
95. Thank you. Thank you for the correction.
Now, does that count include the UK?
Yes, it does. Yep.
Okay. All right. So really 94.
How about Ireland? Have you been to Ireland?
I've not been to Ireland.
Oh.
I have a planned trip for Ireland at the end of this year in October.
Sweet. I think... Yeah. funrover.com. Ben, I forget his last name. Is it Gibbon?
Gribben.
Gribben. Thank you, Gribben. Didn't he move to Republic of Ireland? I think he's there.
I think he did. I don't know if he's moved since. Yeah, but yeah.
He is. So of all the countries
Was he the guest that we interviewed from Ireland and you kept asking him which island?
I think so, yes.
Okay.
So of all the countries you've been to, What's the one not to miss? Like that, you know, you would, if someone would ask you, well, I'm asking you, is there a country that, highly recommend? And is there a country that you can miss?
I'd definitely say give Nigeria a miss unless you have to go through it. Like, you're blocking my way, and the alternatives were great, like Central African Republic and Niger at the time. So I'd definitely give Nigeria a miss. It likens to a war zone, really. You're constantly on your guard. Why is someone talking to me? What do they want? And it's not anything to do with the fun of traveling. It's just a pain, and you have to get through it. It's none of the reasons that I go out travel, which is to meet people and learn about new places and feel relaxed and have a nice time, all the rest of it. It doesn't tick any of those boxes. regards the, you know, the favorite country or the country not to miss, I always hate that question, and inevitably you get asked it in any interview. And my, not necessarily PC answer, but the answer I like to come back with is I like different countries and different places for different reasons. Like, I find a certain type of beauty in the deserts and the wide open expanses and stuff like that. But in the same breath, I find a different type of beauty in coastal regions and mountains, the snow-capped mountains and the Himalaya. So I like a range of places for a whole different bunch of reasons.
Well, let me rephrase the question in a way then. What country surprised you the most that you were anticipating was not going to be a place that you were going to enjoy, but turned out you really did enjoy it?
It's kind of difficult because in a way, or in the age we live in a lot of respects, you have information overload, and you know, you do a lot of research on going into a country, even if it's just a border scenario, and trying to pick up on other overlanders' hints and tips and problems so you can avoid them and have an easier time of it. So in a lot of respects, you're over-informed about a country or the way it works or a lot of the practicalities. But it's more the social interactions, which I think are probably some of the more surprising things, because obviously we've got that mainstream media view of a lot of places. And Colombia, for instance, you know, it's always got a bad rap about the drugs and the FARC rebel groups and this, that, and the other. And, you know, I had a conversation with known FARC guys just down the road from an archaeological dig, and they didn't wish me any, you know, malice in the world, and we were just chatting, and we were talking about their trip and their problem, and they wished me on their way, because their fight's not with tourists, their fight is with their government. So it's kind of funny the type of people you can run into and have a perfectly good conversation with, even though they've got all the, you know, these demonized media behind them and stuff like that. So
do you have any tips for, I'm sure you do, for other overlanders or people considering overlanding? Is there 5, 6, 1 tip that you can give to folks who are considering an overland journey?
Yeah. One of the biggest ones is, and the off-road industry is probably going to hate me for this, is don't waste your money on a lot of bells and whistles. Concentrate on the simple things. Good suspension, good tires, a workable camping setup. Doesn't need to be the most expensive gear in the world. It's like, I think in, was it one of the gear reviews that Overland Journal done recently? There was a $5,000 kitchen setup. It's like, who in their right mind would spend money on that? I don't know. And keep the most of your budget for the traveling, for the day-to-day costs. You know, travel further on less. So just be really practical and minimalistic about the car. And really ask about where you want to take that vehicle. Like, I chose an off-road vehicle because I like doing the off-road back routes. And I like my wild camping as well. So I like that ability to get off the road and get into the bush and you know, just be able to set up and be quiet. A lot of people, that's not particularly their thing, the wild camping thing or whatever. So maybe a van or something else that doesn't cost so much. And yeah, a lot of the things that the off-road industry tries to sell people, everything from like hot water showers to Gucci filtration systems and all this, you have to really dial it back and go for the most simplest and rugged setup you can, and take that travel money that you've hard earned all those overtime hours you've done and actually travel with it, and you'll get a lot more satisfaction out of it.
So, David, on your overland journeys, how many failures did you encounter? I mean, breaking stuff or wearing something out?
Most of it was just little niggles, you know, little electrical faults or the odd bolt coming loose, bits and bobs, you know, maintenance tasks, little leaks, things like that. But the one serious breakdown I had, which I thought I'd really bitten off more than I could chew, was I broke my clutch attempting a river crossing in, well, very close to the edge of the Sun of the Uni in southwest Bolivia. And I was 119 miles from the nearest town when that happened. And obviously in high altitude desert. So quite a serious place to break down.
Were you able to drive without a clutch and limp, or were you just totally dead in the water at that point?
Quite literally totally dead to the water, with water up to the bottom of the doors. So,
oh, lovely.
All right. How'd you get out of it?
Yeah, 117 miles out of the middle of nowhere, I started exploring the area, and I climbed a ridge nearby to get a better view and look for any signs of habitation or nearby tracks. And I could see the dust pouring off the back of this tractor that was plowing fields about 10 miles away. And so I put a few essentials together, like water, sun hat, all that business, and satellite communicator, and then hiked the 10 miles to go find who was driving the tractor. And then in my Spanglish, explained that the stupid gringo had broken his car in a river over the ridge, and then convinced them to come back and pull me out with this big tractor. And then they were amenable to the idea, but after they'd finished plowing their field, and then we drove back with the tractor and set up all the lines and everything. And it was even hard work for the tractor to actually extradite the Land Rover, because it weighs about 3 ton when it's fully laden, and then get it on the dry on the side of the river. And then I was hoping that maybe just Mark or Sliving got in between the clutch plates, but my worst fears were confirmed, that I just had no drive whatsoever. There was just spinning metal where a clutch should be. And a long story short, I had to renegotiate with the tractor driver to then tow me the 117 mile to the nearby town of Uni. But it took about 14 hours at tractor speed off-road.
Wow.
Man,
so that was quite a hellish journey in itself. And then we eventually rolled into Uni, I think at 2 or 3 in the morning, into the most dodgiest South American neighborhood of the town you could possibly think of. So I didn't have any choice but to sleep in the vehicle with it, otherwise it'd been stripped bare by morning. And then make arrangements. Lucky enough, I found a hostel actually with a car yard right next door and the same owners. So we literally had to run and push the Land Rover into the car yard and park it at the back. And then I took a room in the hostel for a week so I could unload my stuff out of it and pull the whole gearbox and everything out and really get to the root of the problem and fix it.
That is a story.
Yeah.
It's going to digest that one. Did you take a lot of spares with you? Like, or do you hope that there's a good network of Land Rover parts?
I take a good, I'll say, stock of service spares, everything from, hub nuts that you go through, wheel bearings, gaskets of all sorts, diff seals, things like that. Stuff that just wears out in due course, and brake pads and air filters. But I tend to use the washable K&N ones just so that I can rotate to. And loads of oil filters and fuel filters and all that. So the majority of the spares are service items more than anything else. And then there's a few spares in there for stuff that you can't bodge or are going to cause you a major hassle to find, like in country. And I leave all the big stuff out. So I don't carry shock absorbers or clutch plates or anything like that. But, DHL can get to a lot of places around the world these days, so...
Yeah, it sounds like a good way to do it. And it sounds like many overlanders seem to be that's the path that they choose. Hopefully they can get something overnighted, or there's usually a Land Rover dealer nearby too, or nearby being, maybe 3 or 4 days away.
Well, to be honest, if you're hot on your maintenance and you know your vehicle, you know when the various bigger components are starting to wear out or you're going to need to stop somewhere and do a major overhaul. And so you just try and plan that in countries which are either Land Rover friendly or more westernized countries where you can buy everything anyway. So
what's next for you, David? Talking before the show, you've been at on the island of Jersey there for what, since August? What's next for you and when?
Well, on day-to-day life, it's back to work, really, and start saving the pennies, and got to do something boring like buying some property or something like that and plan a financial future. But on the adventure side of things, just a whole host of different trips. Like, I like all sorts of sports and stuff. Kayaking is a big thing I'm into, and me and a couple of friends are planning to go to the World Surf Kayak Championships in Northern Ireland in October this year. So that'll be the focus of many other trips. Like, we're planning some surf trips to Portugal, places like that. Then other trips away will be some snowboarding. Looking at going to Jordan at some point in the year. Got the trips to France planned. So yeah, just lots of short trips that are maybe more expensive and not good to do when you're not working and you're on that long-term traveler budget. But, you know, and places which it just it's not practical. You know, you can't overland to, like, you know, Galapagos is high up there on the radar. Yeah. Easter Island is as well. You know, so they're all flying or, you know, take a boat in or something like that. So,
right. And you're also a motorcycle enthusiast too, right? We talked about that before the show, and we should probably touch on that.
Last October I was lucky to get a last-minute place with Austin Vince. Is his name ring a bell with you guys over in the States, or...?
Not me. I'm not a motorcycle guy. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, Austin Vince basically done what Ewan McGregor and Charlie Borman did about 15 years before they done it, and with half the budget and on DR350s. So he's a proper, you know, motorcycle traveling world rebel, really. And he's got this public schoolboy persona as well, which makes him quite funny. And he's been to Overland Expo West on a couple of occasions to do talks there and stuff. It's well worth looking up his his videos and things like that. And in the UK now, he heads up big events like the Travel Film Festival and stuff like that. So now he's quite the motorcycle celebrity, and he's running a series of mini overland bike adventures down in the Pyrenees, in between Spain and beyond the Spanish side, but between Spain and France. And he does a 4-day trail riding and wild camping tour of the area, and it's just really good fun, and you know, good team building, cooking over fires and bivvying out, no proper tents or anything, and lots of good trail riding and getting mucky and falling in mud, and you know, just good old boys own motorcycle trips, really. So that was a great trip to do last October, and then I was lucky enough last weekend I went to the adventure travel, we wouldn't call it a festival, show really, Olympia in London. And there was lots of great talks from all sorts of British-based adventurers as well, like Sean Conway and David Copperwaite, who I think David Copperwaite came up on the American radar when he paddleboarded the Mississippi River, 1,000 miles down the Mississippi River. So.
All right, then. There you go.
Very cool.
I've only crossed the Mississippi in a car. And a plane.
It probably in one of the wide parts too.
Indeed. You haven't written a book?
I'm sort of in the process of 18,000 words into it.
There we go. See, you got a couple good stories already there.
That's a good start.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, like the stories I'm telling you now, it's really the type of stories I tell my mates in the pub or tell people like on shows like this. And it's not going to be one of those all-encompassing, this is the start of the trip, this is the end of the trip. There'll be I've already written the pre-blurb. So it's the background, the trips, the years that I've taken on, and the route that I took. And then the rest of the book is really a collection of these short stories about the interesting and weird and wonderful things that happened along the way. So,
kind of like a travelogue.
Yeah, just taking out the highlights of it.
Well, I hope you, when you complete the book, you're welcome to come back on the show and promote the book and tell everybody about it. I'd like to read it.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah.
Do you have an expectation of when that might be
no,
done?
No, at the moment, that's actually one of my New Year's resolutions, is to sit down for one night of the week and actually do some writing. I've not done any since Christmas at the moment. So, I need to try and enact on that New Year's resolution to keep slogging away at it and fine tuning the stuff I've already written.
Well, hopefully we give you some inspiration to continue writing the book and let everybody, you know, share your stories. sound really interesting. I like the one with the you hiding the defender with camo. That was smart. Did you cover your tracks too?
I did, as far as it leaving the actual trail, because I was a heavily worn four-wheel drive track I was on, and then I actually cut down bushes, like big leafy type plants, and put them and drove over them so that the tire tread didn't actually leave marks in the floor, and then took the bushes back up.
That's very smart. I was wondering, yeah. That was when you told that story, that was one thing I was worried about, was the tracks on the ground.
Yeah, there was a lot more than luck involved there.
Oh, yeah.
What color was this Rover in question?
White, actually, as well.
Oh, my. The worst to have to hide.
Exactly, yeah. Thankfully, it was quite muddy by that stage as well, but yeah, it took a lot of camouflaging. So.
I obviously didn't get a picture of it, I take it.
Well, I've got plenty of pictures of the Land Rover, but no pictures of the actual camouflage one, because it was at night when I was camouflaging it, and then I moved at the crack of dawn, because obviously I wasn't particularly happy that I was secure in that position either. So
no, I understand. Yeah. I completely understand. I'm not saying you should have got a photo.
Not
I just
with
curious.
Them circling around you with searchlights. I don't think you're real secure at all.
Yeah.
I wanted to get out there and get into a public environment as soon as I could.
Especially when you're in a vehicle that can't outrun them.
I'd have given their little Bucky a good run on the terrain we're on. I think the defender would have had the upper hand on that one, actually.
Yeah, until they shoot out your tires.
Well, aiming from the back of a moving Bucky with an AK as well, they'd have to be doing pretty well.
Yeah, but if they've got a few hundred rounds, one of them's likely to find its way.
I think that's one thing you're blessed with in those sort of situations. Those sort of guys don't have a lot of ammunition.
Don't they? Okay, well, that's one point in your favor then.
Yeah, you're lucky if they've got two clips.
So, David, thanks for telling us your stories. I'm looking forward to the travelogue, this or whatever you want to call it, this book. Thanks for coming on and telling us a couple of your stories about your overland adventures and travels.
Yeah, it's been brilliant. You'd never have to try hard to get me to talk about Rovers and overland travel. So.
Good deal. Yeah, if you just want to come back and chit chat and join us on the show, you're certainly welcome to. I know you and I chatted back and forth on Twitter, and again, thanks for coming on and telling us your stories.
Yeah, well, maybe you guys have a look into the background, and if you've got a few more focuses or somewhere in particular in the world that you're interested about that I can chuck in and add content to, then. I'd be happy to come back. It'd be great.
Yeah, good deal. Thanks.
Excellent.
Again. And
we could do a special episode on how to hide your vehicle in the woods.
he's our camo expert. that's a brilliant story. That's just I think we're all going to be thinking about that for a while.
So yeah, pretty up there on the river crossings as well. Yeah, take a look at my YouTube channel. It's just under my name, David Brittis. Just chuck it in the search engine, you'll easily find it. But you'll see just how deep that I'm prepared to take my defender in river crossings. So.
Step one is to make sure you've packed a spare clutch with you, right?
Yeah, well, you live and learn, don't you? Yeah. I think just the next thing about that was one step too far. So.
I will add your YouTube channel to the show notes, so check that out on centersteer.com, and you'll be able to get to David's YouTube channel, which I have not seen yet because just learned about it. Thanks again, David.
No worries. Great to talk to you.
So that's the show for this month of January 2017, show number 46. I want to thank our contributors. Thanks to Harold for coming on the show. No M word this month?
Nope.
Any reason why?
Nope.
Okay. We're going to have one soon again. I know people enjoy them and maybe.
Well, it wasn't a nope.
True. And also thanks to Morgan for joining us on the show today. No heritage segment this month?
No.
Why is that?
Not much time to research the next
Fair
level.
Enough. You know, we didn't talk about your disco and your disco adventures.
Oh yeah.
Because you couldn't join us last month, and we were supposed to talk about them. So give us 2 minutes on your disco adventures.
Sure. Yeah. Well, as many probably know, I've had a Series 388 that I've been very slowly dismantling and rebuilding over the last number of years.
and knocking down trees with.
And knocking down trees with, yes. I was looking for something to do a little more towing of large parts for that project. And so I started looking around. I would have loved to get like a Range Rover Classic or something like that, but they were just outside of my price range. And I ended up finding a good deal on a Disco 2, for better or worse, a 2002. So no center locking diff or anything like that. But overall, pretty good deal. Minor troubleshooting I had to do to get it back on the road.
And then once you got on the road.
And once I got on the road, I sort of, you know, delayed a little too long on switching over to my winter tires. I've recently changed jobs, so my commute is a little different. So I only have one day a week that I commute now, which is very nice, but it's over what's called the App Gap, which is the Appalachian Gap. So it's about about 2,200 feet climb and descent over a few miles, which is fun and beautiful, but it
except when the road is icy.
It's very slippery. The Disco 2 is a very heavy sled.
You're stretching the story out.
What's that?
You're stretching the story out.
Yeah, so coming back one night, the snow was a little too deep for the all seasons, and despite being in first gear low, I started to slide off the hump of the road and ended up, I had a choice of either a rock ledge on one side or a guardrail on the other side, and I chose the guardrail. So slid into it at a very slow speed. And
good choice.
Yeah, exactly. It would have been much harder to get off the rock ledge and probably would have done a lot more damage.
So
very minor damage, just, destroyed the turn indicator and stuff like that. The very unfortunate part was that I couldn't actually get off of the guardrail in those conditions. So I actually had to drive the length of the guardrail until it ended to then extricate myself.
Yikes.
So that sucked.
Nice.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it did its job. It guided you. It's a guide rail. So it guided you on to get off the mountain.
It's true.
So you had, in effect, a very expensive slot car for a short period.
I did, yeah. But it was one of those situations also where I could the path that I slid into the guardrail, there was another vehicle who had clearly done the same thing. They were able to get off the guardrail a little sooner than I was, but I, sat there and watched everybody else fishtail down next to me. So I really could not stay where I was. So the choice was stay and either get hit or continue off. So
have you repaired the side of the vehicle yet?
For the most part, yeah.
Good.
Replaced the indicator lights and straightened the panel back out. I still have a long scrape down the side that I've got to deal with.
Wait till spring, because you never know when that'll happen again.
Exactly.
We call that a pinstripe here.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I was very fortunate. The guardrail was at the exact height to basically stay on all the bump guards all the way down. So very, very little damage considering.
Well,
and I had to help a couple other people along the way home who were stuck as well. So, it was an interesting night.
So the Land Rover did important things for important people.
It tried to, yeah.
Well, we're thank you for telling us the story. We're glad you're okay, and it's your D2 is functional still.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you for telling the story. It's been like 2 months in waiting, I think. So
it has, yes.
And also thank you to our guest this month, Dave Prittis, all the way from Jersey. Thank you, David, for joining us and telling your stories. Not as your stories are more exciting than sliding a Disco 2 down a mountain, but thanks for coming on the show.
I'm glad I didn't have to hide my disco in the woods. So,
well, now I was hunting you down with guns.
Exactly.
or tow it home for 14 hours behind a farm tractor.
Very true.
Rather dull trip home off of work.
Thanks again, David.
Thank you.
Maybe
thank you very much for joining us.
No worries. Great chatting.
And also thanks to the One True Pax for his production support in making the show sound much, much better. That is the podcast for this month. I hope you enjoyed the show, and thank you for listening. Reminder to visit our website for past shows and also show notes for the things we talked about today. And you can get links to all the places that you can find David on the internet. You can connect with us on Facebook and Twitter to give us your feedback on news topics we discussed this month, including design elements of the future of Land Rover. You can also directly support the show by visiting our Patreon account, which is patreon.com/centersteer. If you'd like to be a sponsor of the podcast, go ahead and send us an email. I'd love to hear from you. I am trying to line up some sponsors for the next coming month, and we'd love to hear from you and what you're up to in your Land Rover. So until next time, I ask you to share the show with another Land Rover fan. Thanks for listening. Wave as we pass by. I like the dog at the end. That was good.
It wasn't even my dog.
Whose dog was that? I thought that was yours.
What dog?
Oh, I heard a dog. That must be David's dog.
No, I haven't got a dog.
I heard a dog.